Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your well-being, your community, your region, your society, and everything that we need to be concerned about for the ongoing health and stability of our habitat planet Earth. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, health, and food policy and the media. And each week on the show, we talk with different authors, activists, scientists, advocates, journalists, filmmakers, and a whole host of people that are focusing on different specific facets of everything that concerns our interconnected well-being, health, and political future. So we talk about this on the show. We've been on the air. We're into our ninth year here, and with a variety of guests, and it's a real conversation rather than like a PR setup piece just to sell someone's book. although we do talk to quite a few authors because there's a lot of really interesting writing, journalism, reporting, advocacy, and book authorship going on these days. And, I say this today, we're going to be talking with journalist Eric Levitz, a policy and politics reporter for New York Magazine, who writes in the Intelligencer section of the publication and has been, I've been following his work for a while, doing some really outstanding articles that kind of target, really focus on and target very specific things that are going on and actually understandings, because, all too often, which we discuss frequently on the show as well, and I've been beating this drum, for a number of years because I've been in the media for a number of years, a lot of what's presented in the establishment and mainstream corporate media is a subtle misrepresentation designed to basically get people thinking along the lines that the powers that be in our society would like everyone to run down like lemons. And, as a long-term climate reporter, we can't afford that. So people who are able to kind of deconstruct these misunderstandings are really heavy-duty players in this time, and Eric Levitz is certainly one of them. So happy to have you here on today's show, Eric. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me and the flattering words.
Listen, you recently did an article that, we kind of have a paradigm right now as we're heading into campaign 2020 and debating a number of issues, climate and healthcare and all the rest of where we need to go as a society. People are focused on defeating Donald Trump, obviously. I don't think I've ever had anyone ever on this show or know that many people personally who, are really in favor of him. I mean, what he's been doing just on the climate front alone is absolutely terrifying. But then again, a lot of this was, as I've reported over the years, laid down by Democratic administrations as well. As a result of that tremendous need, some people don't drill into the issues much deeper than that, and therefore have all kinds of notions about what will be required to defeat them, without a lot of nuance about how things are changing, where things are, or what we really need going forward. So in that light, I felt that your recent article of just this past week in the Intelligencer was really interesting and important because it basically delves into the fact that our fear all Republicans are a monolith, they're all standing arrayed against us, and that there's no possibility for shifting within that is really completely debunked by some recent surveys and polls that you have looked at. Can you give our listeners a bit of an overview of what the findings are?
Yeah, sure. So I'd say a couple things on related to what you just said, as far as I do think that there is an open question about how much of you know, current 2016 Republican voters, especially, you know, or people who have been identifying as Republican for multiple election cycles, you know, how much that base is really winnable. But that's a discrete question from like what these individual voters' actual politics are. So there's been a significant body of polling that finds that a very large segment of the Republican base leans left on a whole host of economic issues. They simply choose not to prioritize those issues, or they delude themselves into thinking that the Republican Party either delude themselves or are just ignorant about sufficiently ignorant of politics to believe that there is no tension between supporting the minimum wage hike and supporting the Republican Party, or supporting the expansion of Medicaid and supporting Donald Trump. So open question whether those voters can be won, but the focus of my article is just about, you know, for the body of voters who are winnable, you know, what is and is not a pragmatic agenda for the Democratic Party to run on. And the point that I make based on, there's previous polling, but my piece focused on this large national survey by Data for Progress, a upstart progressive think tank in partnership with Civic Analytics. Civis Analytics, which was a data firm that worked on Obama's reelection campaign, where they pulled a bunch of policies that are either like on the left flank of the current mainstream discourse and debate, or a little bit outside of it, that normally don't get pulled that much. And they also have these mastered this sort of state-of-art demographic technique where you use voter file data in every congressional district and state, and based on, since there is such a correlation between how certain demographics vote at the national level and how they vote in the state and congressional level, if the national poll shows that, you know, whatever, 50% of white men without a college diploma and maybe some other identifiable factor support this policy, then you can sort of model based on, like, okay, what percentage of the electorate is white men without a college diploma in this place, and then figure out about what the support is going to be. Mm-hmm. So what they were able to do is through those that polling and through that data analysis, show so one finding, which, you know, this is actually starting to become a mainstream policy, but legalizing marijuana is really, I think, maybe jarringly popular for some people who, you know, are a little bit older maybe and remember when this was, you know, a majorly divisive and polarizing issue in American politics. You don't need to be that old to remember that, you know, maybe 8 years ago. But I mean, especially, you know, in 1972, whatever, you know, where McGovern's association with hippies or whatever, like, this is a time when it's a real hot button issue. What their polling suggests is that not only is legalizing recreational marijuana and then using the tax funding from that to fund education and healthcare, not only is that majoritarian position, more than 50% of the electorate supports it in every single U.S. state, but actually it's a majoritarian position with just Donald Trump voters in every U.S. state. So except for Mississippi, where it's 48% of Trump voters support, which still is like plurality. But so you go to Alabama, restrict yourself just to people who voted for Donald Trump in Alabama. So that's a conservative, that one of the most conservative blocks of voters you can imagine. And a majority of them want weed to be legal. You know, I think a decent number of 2020 Democratic candidates, I believe that is actually sort of a more mainstream position. I think even Amy Klobuchar, you know, a self-professed moderate, has embraced it. But you still have Democrats in the state legislature in New Jersey where, you know, Governor Phil Murphy wanted that as a major priority and they wouldn't go for it. And there's still a little bit of tension in the party. And it really seems like legal weed would be if you're just trying to win elections, you don't even have any values, it should be something that Democrats should run on.
Right. What about the studies that millennials aren't into God, patriotism, or children, which are kind of almost would be considered and have been, I believe, core values? And even this is true even for Republican millennials.
Yeah, so there was another thing that I wrote about this week, which now it's not as clear cut. So overall, there's been over the last year a lot of public opinion data on millennials and Gen Z that show that they are going to be a major problem for the Republican Party, which is part of why you have Republicans increasingly anxiously defending the Electoral College and trying to colonize the judiciary, basically really focusing on taking over the counter-majoritarian, defending and taking over the counter-majoritarian parts of our government, the ones that don't depend on democratic rule, right? So you get a judge on the bench at 40 years old, that person is going to be able to slap down progressive things, you know, until they die for like four decades, whether or not voters support Republicans. And so that's really where their focus is, because what we're seeing is that millennials and Gen Z, these are the most democratic and left-wing in their policy preferences generation that we've seen. And what lends sort of credence to the opinions that they are espousing on policy issues are a few things. One, it fits with the demographics of the generation. So generally speaking, non-white voters are a little bit more left-wing in average, especially obviously on many racial issues, than white voters are. College-educated voters, college-educated whites tend to be a bit more liberal than non-college whites. Varies a little bit on the issue, but mostly that's the case. And this generation, these generations that are coming up, have higher college attendance rates, and they're much more racially diverse. So you would expect them to be liberal, even if they weren't giving these answers. The other thing that came in this week is that they also, in terms of these questions of like deep values, not policy, but like what is important to you value-wise, they are also quite liberal. Now it's not the case that they're like against patriotism, belief in God, and mm-hmm. and having children, but they're in a poll where you ask Americans like to name, you know, subjects that are very important to their values, not just important or somewhat important, but very important. And for Americans over 55, nearly 80% say patriotism is very important. Over 60% say believing in God is very important. Around the same say having children is very important. Among millennials and Gen Z, patriotism is just above 40%. Belief in God is under 40%, close to 30%, and having children sort of in the same space. And this is significant for a couple reasons. One, because another demographic factor that influences opinion is religiosity, and this is consistent with other data that we have that shows that millennials and Gen Z are much less religious than older voters, and that correlates with liberalism, another sign that their left-wing leanings are going to be durable. And similarly, actually, there is some data to suggest that having children, not everybody, obviously, but in the aggregate, people get a little bit more conservative. They tend to when they have children. The fact that that's not a priority for them also leans in that direction. And the patriotism finding maybe potentially what will make it more possible for sort of a more internationalist priorities like foreign aid, like assisting countries to develop in a less carbon intensive way. Perhaps, you know, these block of voters will be a little bit more open to those kinds of policies than their elders.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask, interject. Are there any, studies that show, I mean, less interested in having children is a value overall, and it's also, a life path, a life choice that has been, that has become more challenging in this time, both for people who are aware of climate change and are not climate deniers and are looking at those trajectories, as well as for people economically burdened by college debt, as is the current generation. And you know, there may be other factors that kind of make people, I mean, I've seen articles, for example, or I guess I saw a news report where they were talking about, you know, in mainstream media, where they were speaking about millennials delaying starting families, having children, without any mention of what the, you know, reasons for that may be, and as if, you know, it's just a matter of delaying and not, you know, maybe kind of ruling that out or finding it hard to achieve in a more long-term sense. Are you aware of, you know, kind of that particular trend? Is there any examination of that in any of the things that you've seen?
Yeah, so I would say that, again, the millennials in this and Gen Zers in this poll, you know, it's not that they're saying that I definitely don't want to have children, just asking whether that's very important to them. You know, and so I don't want to overstate what this shows.
Well, that's this poll,
But to your concern, I do know that there is significant polling showing that, that a high percentage of Americans, and I have to imagine that a lot of millennials are in this category, is that, you know, millennials, the oldest among us, are 38 now, so we would really be in the demographic of people who are having family or at least thinking about it. And there are, I don't have the numbers offhand, but there are polls that show that a lot of Americans say they would have either have children or have more children if they had their druthers, if they could decide, have the exact family they want, they would be having more kids, but it's just not economically feasible for them. So that is definitely, and it's what you would expect if you look at the concentration of jobs in urban centers with extremely high housing costs, the rising cost of childcare, and the failure of really wages even among the professional class to keep up with those rising costs, you would expect pressure to be limiting people's decisions whether to have families or to expand them. So that is definitely an operative factor. Yeah.
And so how does the, you know, that totally makes sense. And can you just also parenthetically, before we kind of go on to the you know, unpacking this further, you know, what is Gen C? Like, what is the age range for Gen C? What is the age range for millennials? Just so our listeners are clear on that.
Yeah. So, well, like I said, I believe in this, that the oldest millennials are now 38, I believe, and Gen Z, I think there's a little bit of some debate over exactly when, you know, you start these things, but basically, I think 1996 might be the conventional cutoff between millennials and Gen Z. So if you're born before 96 and you're a, you know, a young millennial, the youngest of them, and then 1996, you're the oldest of Gen Z, and so I think that might be the cutoff that I'm seeing. I know that 2018 was the first midterm election, so maybe that math, or it depends. I think people might be using different, but Pew Research did a report suggesting that 2018 was Gen Z's first midterm election, and that they posted a turnout rate was that was higher than either millennials or Gen X had turned out at for their first midterm election, which was an encouraging sign that that Gen Z might be more politically active or that might enter the electorate at a slightly more accelerated pace than their predecessors.
Mm-hmm. Well, things are stepping up, so that makes a lot of sense. What about the relative numbers of people in each of these two groups?
Yeah, I don't have that offhand. One thing that I did write about was that partially because of the what I just said about Gen Z entering the electorate and turning out at I believe 30%, which is, you know, not high, but is relative to, you know, young people, 18-year-olds don't tend to vote much. And so that's actually, I'm looking now that millennials and Gen Z, their first midterms, they turned out at 23%. Millennials and Gen X turned out at 23% in their first midterm elections. and Gen Z did it 30%. But so because of that, and because millennial turnout in 2018 skyrocketed from, I think, the previous midterm in 14, they were around like 20% turnout. They went up to 42% in 18. And because of that, for the first time in a midterm election, Gen X and younger, Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z together combined cast more votes than boomers and silent generation and everyone older. That was the first time that and so that was a significant potential inflection point in the evolution of the electorate.
Wow, that's really good news. Yeah, that's really interesting. So in a sense, wrestling, with the mindsets of boomers who are, habituated to a belief in bipartisanship and, incrementalism, one step at a time, that's a good, that's all we need, those kinds of basic notions that have been ingrained in not all, but some members of the boomer generation over many years and, then become a habituated thought pattern that is extremely hard to uproot in some people, that's less of a concern if, a wave is coming in as they kind of phase out. And, so if they are going out with these older ideas that, are no longer operative or as helpful as maybe if they ever were, but certainly not in this current situation where we really have to take control in a major way to protect any form of democracy or basically implement a democracy as opposed to, this overweighting to people of wealth and power and to industries that are destroying our climate, that have a kind of untrammeled, right to do so in the way the current setup is operating, which needs to be, really majorly interrupted and changed immediately for anyone to have a habitable planet in the future. So all of that is really good news in effect. And yet the media discourse on this is so frequently posited around issues of electability, imaginings of what would be, a centrist appeal to wavering Trump voters that, doesn't take into account the shifts that you're reporting on, that you're describing, that are already happening. I mean, what would be a more accurate, approach to the 2020 election than saying, anyone that can defeat Trump and, I don't care what else this person would be doing, doesn't matter as long as they can defeat him. I mean, what you're describing sounds like a weakening position that even the Republicans recognize, but for some reason the Democratic Party is not recognizing, and a whole different approach to who's electable and what kind of president we need now and could get now based upon some of what you're seeing in the polls and the data.
Yeah, I think, there's a few things to say about that. One thing that is unfortunate that has, because millennials have been voting age for a while, like I said, that their participation is increasing, and there is usually an inflection point in every generation where they attain a certain age and start to vote like adults. And devoted higher rates, and millennials are starting to approach that, and it's possible that Donald Trump has accelerated that process by alerting many members of the generation to the importance of civic participation. At the same time, the reason why millennials entering the electorate has not yet dealt Republicans a fatal blow, is because one thing that the conservative coalition is increasingly overrepresented by the structures of our government. So the Electoral College and especially the Senate, the Senate gives every state two votes, no matter how large they are, and the average state in the United States is actually about 6 points more Republican than the country as a whole. But that, combined with also boomers, have actually been moving right. So what is compensated for the older left-wing voters entering the electorate is that the older generation has been growing more conservative. And so that has kind of mitigated so far. I think that we could be, 2018 suggests that we might be on the cusp of a point where that's no longer the case. Actually, older voters moved a little bit back to Democrats. But it's a complicated picture because also as non-college white voters are moving right towards Trump, at least in the last, they've been moving towards Republicans generally over the past decade, and Trump seems to have accelerated that. It's possible that they've reached a peak there, but if that trend continues, there are a lot of non-college white voters who don't vote right now, who Republicans theoretically could bring into the electorate that could complicate things. So there's a lot of variables, and it's hard to know exactly how everything is going to shake out. That said, the point that I emphasize is that even if you assume that the boomers are going to maintain their share of the electorate, or they're going to move right such that even though there's fewer of them, that there's still going to be a problem, or that these sort of swing voting non-college whites are going to be a major presence in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, and we really need to worry about what they care about, which I think is there's a strong case for believing that. My argument is that it's not the case that the more progressive you are in any given issue, the less electable you are, that there's no tight correlation between that at all, because individuals' policy preferences are generally a mixed bag. Most voters, the ordinary voters, are not that ideologically sophisticated insofar as they don't their positions on issues aren't determined by, you know, their abstract philosophy of government. You know, the average Republican voter has not read a ton of like Friedrich Hayek and Ayn Rand and doesn't have strong feelings about that. They have, you know, they have intuitions about what's fair, and they have intuitions about which social groups they belong to and which social groups they resent, and judge policies based on whether it sounds fair and whether it seems like it benefits their social groups or benefits someone else. And so some of the polling that I was talking about earlier, you know, one thing that is a somewhat radical policy in the American context is allowing workers to have acquiring large companies to put representatives of their employees on their corporate boards. So Elizabeth Warren has a proposal that I think Sanders also has as well, of putting, 40% of every major corporation's board needs to be elected by its workers, so that when you have meetings to discuss, okay, we have unexpected profits from these Trump tax cuts, how are we going to spend these profits? Do we give them to shareholders? Do we pay them out in wages? That you can have workers in the room to say and influence those decisions. This is prevalent in Western Europe. It's a pillar of Germany's economic model. And studies suggest that this, as one would expect, if you put workers in the room, it changes how corporations spend their money, so that you could actually redistribute a ton of income, not through taxing and transferring, but simply through changing the balance of power within corporations. And the polling that I was looking at earlier, that policy, if you tell people, and actually the poll even presents it as a Democratic proposal, and it presents Republican arguments against it. And even with that framing, it has positive approval in all 50 states because, you know, voters here, well, as the typical voter, who do they identify with workers more than they identify with, you know, major shareholders at corporations. And so it's their social group gets benefited, not the other one. And putting Republicans in the position of having to argue, well, no, you shouldn't put workers on corporate boards because then it'll be bad for the economy because workers don't know anything. You know, that's not an argument that Republicans want to make. So I think that that's actually a great policy to support. It's like left-wing if you charted it on our left-right ideological axis, but it's not in terms of public opinion. And I think there are a lot of things like that where, especially on economic issues, though there are some other ones, but where, the major party systems do not, the major parties do not represent opinion. The positions of major parties are determined largely by, you know, the power of their most active factions, their most well-heeled factions, their donors, their interest groups, their well-organized constituencies. And the opinion of just the typical voter if that voter isn't organized and isn't fighting an internal party battle, it really doesn't matter. And so there's a lot of issues where the Republican Party simply doesn't represent the views of its constituents. And more importantly, there's a lot of issues where these, that small, strange fraction of the population that doesn't know what team it's on still, the 8% of whatever it is in these key states, there are a lot of issues where actually moving left, arguably on those specific issues, actually may benefit winning over these swing voters.
Mm-hmm. There was a recent article in Newsweek that Republican voters, younger Republican voters, are also worried about climate change. You know, they're not in the category of denial, and in that they kind of are more with, their generation than with, this traditional corporate-generated climate denial. I don't know if that's a major issue, but, there's more realism about that. Any comments or thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think the fact that they're still identifying as Republicans, at this mm-hmm. juncture and how clear the GOP's climate policies are suggests that perhaps that they're concerned, but they're not that concerned. But it's also possible that this might be a weak point in they've got an inherited Republican identity from their family and they're maybe slowly working away from it. But I do think more broadly, one thing I wrote about a few months ago is that climate, the public is increasingly on the Democrat side, but also just environmental issues in general is a real strength for the Democratic Party that I don't think that they take advantage of enough. And sometimes that intersects with climate. So in terms of clean air and clean water, even Trump pretends to support those things. But his administration at the EPA has been implementing policies that are just, horrendously unpopular with everybody. Generally speaking, the idea, if you ask people, would you like it to make it easier for corporations to poison your children so they have higher profits? People don't want that, right? And so there's the... it's some chemical manufacturing. Forget what the chemical is offhand. There are these plants in, I think, outside the Houston suburbs. I believe it's some type of phosphate that basically there was a regulation under the Obama administration that this company was supposed to invest $300 million to put in this safety thing that cleans the toxins that they exude, there is a technology that makes this less hazardous to the public health, but it's very expensive, and the company didn't want to do it. Trump lifted that, and now that's going to probably produce a surplus early deaths of, some many thousands, according to EPA's research, in, this part of Texas. Democrats aren't talking that much about that. But the polling shows that actually there's no issue in which the public trusts Democrats more than Republicans, not health care, even though that's a strong issue for Democrats, none. The environment, they're, when you ask people which party you trust in the environment, like 60-something percent say, if the environment was the only issue, I would vote for Democrats. And I think Democrats could be doing more to heighten the salience of that issue.
Mm-hmm. What about... if you could kind of help redesign people's understanding in this, changing and transforming context, of what constitutes electability, or is there even such a thing, and is that just a kind of PR term, designed to kind of lead people down a certain pathway, and it's not even in any way a useful criteria? Do we need to adjust our considerations about that? I mean, what would your thoughts on that be?
Yeah, I mean, I think my few thoughts, it's a tricky thing. I think that that in general, there isn't much evidence to support, you know, a sort of very conventional understanding of electability that just, you know, that the more, like I was saying before, you know, the more your policy is just to the left of Republicans, the more electable you're going to be. There's no real basis for believing anything along those lines. And then the whole concept is a little bit difficult because it's just, you know, when you have studies that try to determine, you know, what the political effects of something is, you know, with elections, like our sample size is so small, and also the conditions are changing every election in terms of, you know, what the electorate is. So it's very hard to say anything with confidence. That said, I think that there is something to the idea that if you have a left-wing candidate who is taking who is principled to the point of taking the left-wing position on every single issue, it is the case that public opinion is not there on every single issue. And so if you have one candidate who is a total opportunist, is just saying, doing whatever the polls say on each individual issue, to the point where also they're like not being constrained by corporate donors on issues where the conservative position is actually unpopular or the centrist position is actually unpopular, you know, that person, there's some basis for believing maybe they would be more electable. It's hard to tell because the public, it's not entirely clear exactly how much issue positions actually influence voting behavior, because a lot of voters are not actually familiar with where people sit. But so, for example, you know, reparations for African Americans for slavery and redlining and Jim Crow is, in my opinion, an unassailably morally correct policy. It's also, you know, polls at 20-30%. You know, so if you had a candidate who took that position, also abolish ICE is another thing that actually I don't think is that radical in substance, but it doesn't poll well. So you have that combined with the fact that you have these swing voters in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania. You know, turnout can perhaps make them less important, but you do have very strange voters. I mean, I think if you try to put yourself in the position of a voter who like does not understand yet whether or not they support Donald Trump's reelection, these are people that are not going. They don't think exactly like us. And it's hard to know what is going to press the right buttons with them. I think we have some indications that, you know, generally speaking, they trust Democrats on health care. A lot of these white voters trust Democrats on health care and trust Republicans more on immigration. And the more we can talk about health care and emphasize these pocketbook issues with them, that's probably better than focusing on immigration. But It's a mixed bag, and I think the main, you know, thing is that it's just it's not at all nominating a self-styled centrist is not necessarily going to be the safe thing to do, you know, and a lot comes down also to just candidate charisma, just do people like the person, is, you know, I think that plays often a bigger role than positioning. You know, I think if you look at, you know, whatever else you want to say about Barack Obama and whatever else you want to say about Bill Clinton, they were very politically talented. They were charismatic figures.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I don't think it's a coincidence that they won elections, you know. So,
right.
So I think that that's another factor.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Definitely. Well, you know, one of the things is, I mean, the Democratic lineup of, you know, a large number of candidates, which is, you know, starting out with 20 plus candidates, it's being winnowed down. You know, basically, given the short amount of time to bring up issues at the debates, you know, results in people, you know, basically responding. You know, it's like a charisma test or a, you know, a kind of test in what we've been taught would be a winnable demographic rather, you know, than charisma. So on the one hand, we've been taught, you know, a black candidate will pull in black voters and, you know, and then that will be a winning ticket, you know. And on the other hand, we're kind of going for who do we like, where we're not looking at policy, as you point out, you know, not because not everybody does look at policy. I mean, I had one person commenting who was basically like, all people prefer a white male alpha figure they can look up to. You know, all Americans want to vote for that, somebody asserted. I mean, is that even true anymore, given the demographic?
I don't see, I'm not sure why that, I mean, obviously not all, definitely not all. It's not really clear what, I mean, one factor that I haven't mentioned that I think is something to keep an eye on, and that argues against that is the fact that Democrats in the Trump era have really been making their biggest gains with female voters, with women. I think that for a long time in Hillary Clinton's campaign, it was sort of a disappointment that the first female nominee did not inspire a bigger gender gap in Democrats' favor, that it seemed to drive away as many men as it attracted women. But the experience of seeing Hillary Clinton, of seeing this first female nominee lose to the personification of misogyny, and then Me Too on top of that, I think has really politicized a lot of suburban professional women who maybe were voting Republican because their husbands did, and now they have kind of a greater political consciousness of, not realizing that sexual harassment was even a political issue, and not thinking about which party is for or against, the kind of mistreatment that they took as a given in their workplaces. And I think that's been one major factor. And then we also see in polls that white working class women who voted for Trump, they're moving away from him a lot more than white working class men are, that they're a lot more up for grabs. And so this is how women break in 2020 is really going to determine a lot of things. And if you have the right female candidate, it's possible that could help. It's not definite, but just in terms of we need to nominate an alpha male because that's the safe thing to do. I don't think that's clear for those reasons.
And you don't cover climate-related issues that much, but what do you think it signifies that young Republicans are now more conservative, concerned about environment and climate, and are just, so this whole brainwashing, I mean, with the passing of David Koch, his brother Charles Koch is still with us, but, they had a kind of very heavy influence, I mean, is that waning, or people are just waking up to, the reality around this? I mean, what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that the one thing that makes me not draw as much hope from that as I would like to is that I don't think that climate denial is the main obstacle ultimately. It's a very American phenomenon. In Europe, throughout much of the rest of the world, in China, the opposition to doing what actually needs to be done to get emissions under control is not really based on denying that climate exists. That climate change is a man-made phenomenon or any of the really hard facts of the science. It's just people just don't. There's enough industry money behind opposition, plus enough just people, not wanting to make sacrifices in the present for this abstract, slow-moving threat. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult political issue for reasons, even when you accept the reality of climate. And then if you look at, even once you accept and decide that radical things need to be done on climate, it is possible to take that in a far-right direction, as we saw with the shooter in El Paso, for example. His manifesto is an eco-fascist manifesto. It is climate change is happening. Fewer resources are going to be around. So we need less people. We need to start killing non-white people. Obviously, I don't think that the average Republican in that poll that's what they're thinking. But you can have less extreme than that reactionary positions on climate where it's, you take a zero-sum worldview and you say, well, we're going to have fewer resources, so harden the border, stop taking immigrants, whatever. There are all kinds of different ways that the politics of an era of climate catastrophe can go. And so just getting people to accept the science is an important first step, but it's not, your work isn't done at that point. You then need to really, figure out how to get people behind policies that are a sane and humane way to deal with the reality. I think that a decent number of young Republican voters would just want a conservative party that actually just did take this issue seriously, because they are just genuinely worried about what life is going to be like for them. I don't know. I think that it might not be as significant as we would like it to be.
Are there any, what is your view on the whole Electoral College thing? You say the Republicans are, wanting to preserve it. I mean, what is your view on it? Do you think we need to get rid of it? Do you think there's an avenue to doing that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's an absurd system that should be abolished. There's a National Popular Vote Compact where, states commit to pledging their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote once enough states have done that, such that they would have the power to just determine the president. That's the most viable route, though even that one seems doubtful that they'll be able to get to the right numbers. Although I think there is a chance, because of the demographic stuff that we were talking about earlier, a combination of Gen Z and the millennials entering the electorate, plus the fact that we're right now having increasingly polarization along urban and rural lines, where urban and suburban areas are moving towards Democrats and low density areas are moving towards Republicans. The state of Texas is actually an urban and suburban heavy place. It has large stretches of rural area, but they're extremely underpopulated. So if you have demographic change plus urban suburban polarization, which is part of how Beto came within 2 points of winning a statewide race there, it's quite conceivable that within the next decade, Texas becomes a 51 or 52% blue state, in which case the Electoral College will be massively biased in favor of Democrats. And I think at that point, you may see Republicans turn on it, and then there might actually, because a lot of Democrats are actually principled in their opposition to the Electoral College, you might actually have a bipartisan coalition willing to scrap it at that point. But I don't think it's going to happen until it screws over Republicans. That's my take.
What are you looking at upcoming as kind of key trends that you're looking into?
In terms of the near-term future, I mean, the big question as far as the Democratic primary is, about how solid Biden's base of support is, which it's very heavily you do see what we were talking about earlier with millennials is very much reflected in preference in the party primary, where younger voters are going generally strongly for Sanders or Warren, and older voters are behind Biden, a large part of his support base. I think a big question is going to be what the turnout dynamics within the Democratic primary are. Generally speaking, primaries, in my understanding, voters skew older for primaries even than general elections. And if that's the case, and something majorly disruptive doesn't happen, Biden could be in a very strong position. But if the electorate evolves faster than we had anticipated, that could potentially change things. That's one thing I'm looking at.
I mean, one of the things that occurs to me, I mean, it's also said that Warren voters skew older, and more educated than Sanders voters. I mean, there have been polls that found that. So does she kind of represent more of a, a kind of undermining of Biden?
Yeah, I don't know. These are sort of small subsamples, often with the, but there have been polls that show that Morning Consult has consistently found that, somewhat ironically, that the second choice among Biden voters is Bernie Sanders, and the second choice among Bernie Sanders, the most popular second choice among Bernie Sanders voters, is Joe Biden. And both Biden and Bernie do well among non-college educated voters. Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, and again, you know, the voters are just not as ideological as a lot of the times we like to imagine them. I think it's partially name recognition, but I think there are some voters who maybe, you know, they like whoever's familiar, and maybe they do like, you know, sort of an older guy who they know, and who, yeah, I mean, I think that Biden, you know, obviously has very different politics, but he does talk about unions a lot. He does talk about class a lot, as does Bernie. So there is a category of voter who likes Biden and likes Bernie. And we've seen that, I think, Warren and Kamala Harris share a lot of voters. I do think at this point, Warren and Bernie are in competition for some of the same, for a significant, partially because Harris has faded, and I think things could change, but right now it looks the past couple of weeks of polling has shown a three person race really between Biden, Warren, and Sanders. But it isn't, yeah, for the reason I was just saying, it's not actually, I mean, they're competing for some of the same voters, but it's not actually clear if one of them were to drop out at this point. It's quite possible that Biden would gain on the other one that was left. It's possible that they're taking more votes from Biden than they are from each other. It's not clear at this point.
You know, the other thing that strikes me is the lapses and misspeakings, you know, could be perceived, be normalized among an older group because, hey, I'm forgetful too or whatever, you know, although, in fact, if you were thinking it through clearly, that should worry you, you know. Is it more worrying or disturbing, do you think, to younger voters, even uneducated ones, educated and uneducated? I mean, you know, he's made one kind of bumble after another. How can somebody lead who can't track information?
Right. Yeah. And I think in the age thing, it is a real, you know, it's not just about age, because I do think partially Sanders is just exceptionally with it and on the ball and spry for someone his age, whereas Biden is not. But it's quite clear when you look at the two of them, you know, it's not just age that's the factor here, you know, because Bernie is not having the same kind of misstatements. But yeah, I'm not sure. I think one factor might be that I believe, based on the information that we have, that Biden's voters probably paid just less attention to the news and to the debates and to stuff this far out. So generally speaking, hyper-engaged voters, voters who are on Twitter, you know, voters who are really, they read political news every day, they tend to skew more progressive and more ideological, you know, those who are really invested. Whereas his support base, there's, you know, some people like that, but generally speaking, you know, his support base is older, is more, identifies as more moderate, and yeah, a little less college educated. And so I think a decent number of these voters, you know, are older voters who, they're not paying close attention, you know, especially this far out. They might not be that aware of his gaffes, and they just like, oh, Biden, yeah, Obama's, you know, wingman. I liked Obama. I like Biden. Biden. So not that that's everybody, but I think that might be one factor of why it hasn't mattered as much as one might expect.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we're coming to the end of our show time today on Connect the Dots, and it's really been wonderful hearing your perspective and your kind of grasp of some of these complex issues and, you know, what the data is showing and what some potentials, you know, are given in the current climate. So we've been talking today with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine and their Intelligencer Comment. You can find many of his terrific articles online at New York Magazine. We've been discussing several of them, and you know, really good analysis and really grounded in emerging information. So, you know, really appreciate your columns and what you're exploring, and they're also, you know, very enjoyable to read and literate and terrific. So thank you so much, Eric, for your work and for being with us today and Connect the Dots.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. You can also find all our past programs as well as share this one by going to connectthedots.podbean.com. And there you'll find this interview. You can share it with your friends in social media, as well as past shows on, you know, the wide-ranging topics that we cover here on Connect the Dots. So thank you for being with us, listeners, this week. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well, heads up, and keep marching forward.